So when we ask ourselves the question, who are we? The next question has to be, how do we even know what we know about ourselves? When we ask ourselves questions of our origins or our history, or the origins of our universe, or how creation began, what we find is that as different as the answers appear to be, our answers primarily come from two sources of information. In the Western world, we rely primarily on two sources of information to tell us all that we know about ourselves and our world and the cosmos beyond. We call those science and spiritual traditions, or in some respects, religion. I have to be very careful when I use the word religion in this respect, because I'm not speaking about the rules and the dogma per se. Rather, I am speaking about the history and the understandings that those spiritual traditions bring to bear upon our world today. Does a clone have a soul? Life is made of four elements: carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, and that's it. Four elements of the earth. When do those four elements become life? Isn't that interesting? And even more, when does life become human? How do we know the answer to these things? If something is consciousness, does it mean it's living? Or if it's living, does it mean it has a consciousness? We're going to share some research today. While we may not answer these questions, we're laying the foundation of the kind of information, and you will have the information to form your own opinions of these and many, many more things. Before we even do that, we have to ask ourselves a question. When we have the opinions that we have about our world, how do we even know what we know? Have you ever thought about that? How do we know what we know in our lifetime? Where does our information come from? What are our primary sources of knowledge? A long time ago, our primary source of knowledge was direct experience. When someone in a family or a tribe would have a vision or a dream or a strong intuitive sense, the rest of the family or the tribe or the community would listen and they would honor that. That, to a greater degree, has not happened in our culture right now. Other cultures, it does. In our culture, we learn less through direct experience, and I think that's changing, because we're all remembering how important our direct experience is. Besides the direct experience, our two primary sources of knowledge are science and what we call religious or spiritual traditions. Science and religion. Historically, science and religion have been considered incompatible. How many of you have heard that, or have you felt that, that you have to choose one perspective or another? Well, there's something happening that may be of great relief to you then, so you don't have to feel that tension any longer. Historically, science and religion have been considered incompatible. We're now finding that they are related in ways that we're only beginning to understand. But I come from the world of science. My training is in background is in the hard sciences, and I support the scientific method. However, as good as science is, the best scientists will tell you that it's incomplete. Science only began about 400 years ago. 400 years ago, science began to break our world, the unity of our world, into little pieces so that we could feel comfortable understanding them and studying them. We call those building blocks our sciences of physics, biology, chemistry, geology, maybe mathematics. And we've done a very good job of this. We understand the building blocks very well. Now, the great challenge in science is, how do we unify those building blocks into a story that accounts for everything we see in our world? Science is looking for the unified theory. But this is the great question. How do we unify these theories? Science is incomplete, as good as it is, on one hand. On the other hand, ancient religious and spiritual traditions, in their way, they say to us that they preserve a great mystical secret in their traditions that fills in the missing gaps of the science. Now, I've worked with a lot of science and engineers, and when I would come in on Monday morning and share what I was finding in my studies over the weekend, with the exception of a few people, they would say to me, "We understand what you're saying, but what difference could it possibly make in the world of high-tech computers and science today? What difference could ancient spiritual and religious traditions make? What could they say to us that we can't find through science?" You'll see what they're going to say here in just a moment. Ancient traditions are said to preserve a great mystical secret as the story of creation. Almost universally, ancient texts, traditions, oral traditions, written traditions, they say to us a long time ago, and this isn't my language, this is right out of the Dead Sea Scrolls, that the wisdom of the heavens was given to the family of man, that there was a transmission, a one-way transmission. A long, long time ago in human history, we were given the story of who we are, where we come from, how we relate to this world, to one another, to our Creator, in the language of another time. And they preserved that story in the language that doesn't make a lot of sense to us today. With that information, we were given the power to bring peace to our world. We were given the power to bring healing to our bodies, to end the suffering of humankind. And the interesting thing is, as different as the peace of our world seems to be, and the healing of our bodies seems to be, as different as they appear, they are actually related through the power of a force that we're only beginning to understand. The peace in the Middle East, the peace in Africa, the peace in the large cities of our nation, and the healing of our bodies are related through a force. Now, for some of you, you're saying, okay, I already know that. For others, this is a very different way of looking at our world. It's a very different way of thinking about things. So I'm going to thank you right now for your willingness to explore a new possibility. So what I'd like to do is describe how this force works in our lives through a verbal flowchart. And I'll do it one way now, and then we'll address this chart later on in the program, and we'll use different words based in our explorations and the understandings of modern science, and we'll begin to see that Western science and ancient spiritual traditions were in fact describing precisely the same form of energy, the same force, using very, very different languages for the same applications. In addition to visualizing this flowchart of the spiritual process on the whiteboard of your mind, there is also a copy of this in the CD-ROM guidebook. So the flowchart begins like this. In the whiteboard of your mind, if you can imagine a little box that simply says that there's something that we do in our lives, something that we choose to do in our lives. It's a way that we choose, a code of conduct, the way that we choose to conduct ourselves in a daily basis in the presence of those that we love and hold dear. Something we do in our lives, and a little arrow from that box that points to another box that says that that's something we do. It triggers a process in our bodies. Something begins to change in our bodies. There's a chemical change that happens within the cells of our bodies. And from that little box, another arrow that points to a box that says once our bodies begin to change, that the change inside of our bodies interacts with the forces of creation beyond our bodies. Something that we do in our lives triggers a process inside of our bodies. And that process interacts with forces beyond our bodies. And the last box of our flowchart, then the arrow points to the last box and says that the change inside of our bodies is actually affecting our physical world. When we do something in our lives that triggers a process in our bodies and it affects the world around us, if we do not understand how this relationship works, we believe that we have just experienced a miracle. And this is the perspective of the ancient and the spiritual traditions. Through the understandings now of Western science, science is saying there's a field out there that links everything together. Spiritual traditions are saying this is how we use a field of energy that links everything together. Now we have to ask ourselves the question, are they speaking about the same thing? Could the great mystery that unifies all that we know about science and the great secret of the spiritual traditions that allows us to influence the world around us through something we do inside of our bodies, could they be related? Or we can take it one step further, are they the same force? In the traditions of the ancients, almost universally, there is a wisdom that says to us, there's something that we can do every day in our lives. Something we do in our lives triggers a process in our bodies. And that process interacts with the forces of creation around us and affects our physical world, and when that happens, creates what we call miracles. They're only miracles until we recognize that we are related to all that we see in our world through a force that quantum physics is just beginning to understand. Then they're no longer miracles, they become a technology, something we can use and apply with wisdom and meaning in our lives. Something we do in our lives triggers a process in our bodies. That process interacts with the world around us and changes our world. This is what the ancient spiritual traditions are saying to us in the language of their time. So now the question that many people are asking, we have this great mystery of science. How do we unify all that we know about our world? The great secret of spiritual traditions, something we do in our bodies affects our world. Could they be related in some way? Could the mystery and the secret be related? Well, what many researchers now are beginning to suspect is not only are they related, they're the same. They're equal. They're saying the same thing in very different languages. If we can get past our judgments of what science or religion is saying to us and look to the heart, to the essence of what has been left for us, we have the opportunity to create a wisdom that carries us beyond the greatest challenges that we'll ever face in any generation, if we have that wisdom. September 11th, I was out of this country. I was in Australia on a workshop, a seminar, and a book tour. When I did come back into the country, I immediately was booked into three conferences, not seminars like this, but conferences with many other speakers. And something interesting happened. The speakers had never gotten together before the program to plan or scheme anything. And at some point in the workshop, the presentation of every speaker, this slide came across the screen. Every single speaker after September 11th. The slide says, it's from Albert Einstein, says the significant problems we face today cannot be solved at the same level of thinking we were at when we created them. And you said that makes tremendous sense. There was one kind of thinking, one consciousness that's created the problems. We've got to move beyond that and think differently to transcend the problems that that thinking created. Well, the presenters were using this and applying it to what happened on September 11th. And we did the same thing. I believe this is such a brilliant statement. It applies to nearly everything that we could bring up in our world today and what's happening today. So this is a very different way of looking at our world. Science and religion have traditionally been viewed as being opposed to one another. Science versus religion. What if we say, rather than science versus religion, what if we marry them together? What happens if we marry the wisdom that was preserved intact, the completeness of our most cherished spiritual and religious traditions with what the science, the bits and pieces that science now has shared with us, what if we marry them together? Many researchers are beginning to suspect that science and religion are both fragments of a greater and much older wisdom. That the science describes, in today's language, why our world works the way it works. Science tells us why, when we combine hydrogen and oxygen, we get the water. But that wasn't important 5,000 years ago. 5,000 years ago, they didn't need to know the why, they just needed to know what to do with it. Religions and spiritual traditions describe how we apply the knowledge. They didn't need to know the why. And I find this today, it's very interesting. When we do programs in this country, in the West, our left brains, we're a very left-brain society, we need to know, where's that come from? Where'd you find that? Where can I get the research? Prove it to me. Show me how this works. Many ancient traditions, they acknowledged that it works. They didn't need to prove it, and they applied it in their lives. So when I do programs in other parts of the world, the language changes. Now we're suspecting that science and religion actually require one another to be complete. And as we marry our two greatest sources of knowledge, as we marry our spiritual heritage with the most advanced science in recorded human history, we have the opportunity to answer the great questions of who we are, how we relate to one another, our world, ultimately our Creator. And to begin doing that, I believe we have to go back and look at that transmission. What was given to us a long time ago? What happened when the wisdom of the heavens was given to the children of this earth? This is where it gets really interesting. So I think this illustrates an interesting point, and perhaps why we are on the verge, at the dawn of a new understanding that is so powerful in ways we've never had in the past, of marrying these two traditions together. So science, is telling us why things work the way they work. The spiritual traditions are accepting that those things do work, and they are describing how we apply this knowledge in our lives. They actually appear to require one another for the completeness of a greater wisdom. So if this is truly the case, now we have to go back and ask ourselves the question, if these relationships exist, and if the scientific understandings are incomplete, and if ancient spiritual traditions are more complete in some respects, simply using a language that's very different than the language that we're used to hearing in the West today, then it may behoove us to understand what was given to us with the wisdom of the heavens. When our ancient ancestors were given the understandings, when they were handed the wisdom to understand what these relationships mean in our lives, what was really shared with them, and what does it mean in our lives today? Well, to understand this, we've got to go back and look at the lineage, look at the history of wisdom as it has come down to us today from the ancients. We begin to understand that we are experiencing what some scholars call a broken chain of knowledge. There's a lineage of wisdom that extends for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of generations into our past. And what we know is that throughout time, that wisdom has been edited. It has been deleted. Portions of the information have been captured and stored in great libraries. Some of it has been lost as those libraries are destroyed. If we're to go back and look at this lineage of wisdom and what has happened through the ages, we can identify two key times in our history when the chain of knowledge that links our modern world with our ancient ancestors has been broken. Two great breaks in our chain of wisdom. And the first of those is what is called the Great Library of Alexandria. Now, I'm always amazed when I'm with live audiences and I ask people, I'll say, how many people have ever heard of the Library of Alexandria? Everybody raises their hand. And I say, how many know what was in that library? And rarely do I see more than two or three hands go up. We've heard of the library. We don't really know about what was in there. And I'm not surprised. The Great Library of Alexandria was destroyed by a fire from a civil war in 48 BC. It was created by the Greek Emperor Ptolemy I, and it was actually called a universal library, to the best of my knowledge. This is the first great library that was ever created for the sole purpose of preserving the information of human history from our very beginnings under one roof. The Emperor Ptolemy, he had the luxury of sending entire armies into all the known world, and their orders were to bring back a single copy of every text, every manuscript, every book that had ever been written, one copy to place into what was called the Universal Library to preserve the memory of mankind. Well, the library, as we said, was burned in the fire during the Civil War. However, before it was burned, the Roman historian Callimachos was given the job of cataloging what was in this library. And we do have Callimachos' records, even though the library itself was destroyed. Callimachos documented in the Great Library of Alexandria over 400,000 scrolls that he described as mixed. And I had to investigate a little further to understand what a mixed scroll really means. A mixed scroll means that there were multiple authors contained on a single scroll. So over 400,000 mixed scrolls were in the Library of Alexandria. Over 90,000 additional scrolls were what he called unmixed, or scrolls of a single author. And an additional 42,000 scrolls that were not associated with any author at all, for a total of over 532,000 documents that were lost in that fire. And while we don't have the documents today, what Callimachos says to us is that included in those documents were some of the most ancient Hebraic documents, ancient Phoenician texts, Egyptian documents talking about the optics of ground glass and the medicines of Egypt. The entire Greek library was contained in the Library of Alexandria. What we know is when this fire burned the library and this information was lost, we know that we lost tremendous amounts of information, and that was one of the first breaks in the chain of wisdom. The second great break came during the religious persecutions after the crucifixion of Jesus. What we know is this, that in the 4th century, During the year 325 AD, the Western biblical texts as we see them today did not exist. There was no nice, neat biblical text compiled into a book the way that we see today. There was a loose assemblage of manuscripts and documents. Some of them were poorly written. Some of them were redundant. Some of them were so mystical that even the scholars of the time had no idea what they meant. And they said, well, if we don't understand them, no one will ever understand them, so we might as well throw these documents out. So what the best biblical scholars of today will acknowledge is that at its very best, our Western Bible is incomplete. Let me ask a question. If you're listening to this, you probably have had the opportunity to read at least a portion of our Western Bible. Have you ever felt like part of it was incomplete? Have you ever read the book of Genesis, for example? In the beginning, not much was happening, and all of a sudden, a lot of things were happening, and it happens in a single paragraph. Have you ever wondered why that is? Where are all the women in the biblical text? We know that women were alive 2,000 years ago and beyond, and we know that some of them were literate and they could write. Where are their documents? Where are their texts? Well, the answer to these questions, and this is part of the value of going back into some of our most cherished traditions, is that we begin to recover documents that were edited and lost. And while what we have today is good, our Western Bible, it's a good text. It simply is incomplete. And the best biblical scholars will acknowledge that. What we know is that in the 4th century, in the year 325 AD, during what is known as the Council of Nicaea, at least 45 entire books were removed from our modern biblical text. 45 books were removed, and the ones that remained were condensed and rearranged into the story that we have today. So when we ask ourselves, where are all the women in the Bible? For example, we know of the books that were lost, there was an entire gospel of the birth of Mary. The birth of Mary describing her lineage as an Essene master and her being raised in a wisdom that supported the mystery and the understanding of our relationship to the forces of nature around us for health, for healing, for peace and survival. We know, for example, that there was not only one, there were two books describing the infancy of Jesus before he became the master as an adult. And to me, these books are fascinating. Infancy, book one, infancy, book two. And they're fascinating to me because they describe a young male and they describe a young boy in ancient times coming to terms with a power that lives within his body that makes him so very, very different from the other children his age and what it means to him. There are stories, for example, in the book of infancy of Jesus, book one, there's a story of Jesus playing with other children approximately his own age. And they're by a small stream and they're fashioning small clay animals, small birds, out of the clay in the stream. And Jesus becomes frustrated, according to this text, because the animals are lifeless and they don't do anything. And he breathes life into these small clay animals and they become animated, they become alive. And the other boys go home and tell their parents, and their parents get together with Jesus' parents and have a parent conference. And Jesus is helped to understand that he has powers and abilities that others do not have, and that there's a responsibility that comes with that. And from those kinds of stories, he learns that responsibility in his life. And for me, it makes him more accessible as a human because he came into this world through the womb of a woman, and he came to terms with what his life meant to him, much the way we're asked to do today through the trials and the challenges and the tribulations and the hurts and the joys of our lives. And without seeing these kinds of texts, we never get to understand that about the man Jesus. In the edited books of our Western Bible, there are an amazing series of documents, the letters of Herod and Pilate, a fascinating dialogue between Pontius Pilate, the governor who was responsible for the crucifixion of Jesus, and King Herod. And the correspondence begins immediately after the crucifixion, and I'll just paraphrase a little bit about what these letters are all about. Immediately after the crucifixion, Pontius Pilate wrote the letter to King Herod, and he said, in effect, Herod, I think we've just made a really big mistake. And Herod attempted to distance himself from the entire situation. He wrote the letter back, and he said, well, Pilate, what do you mean, we? He said, I had nothing to do with it, and the state of Rome had no interest in this man's death. That was a local decision. And it's a fascinating dialogue between the two men trying to come to terms with what they knew was a momentous and historic event. So I'm sharing these kinds of stories just to give an idea, some idea of how important it is. Now that we know information was lost and we're beginning to recover this information, this is the kind of thing that we're finding. At least 45 books were removed. We know some of them were removed completely and never seen again. They were stored in the vaults of the Vatican libraries, and we find them today in private libraries such as the Habsburgs in Germany. Other books were reserved for scholars only, such as the first and the second book of Adam and Eve, the Secrets of Enoch, the Psalms of Solomon. There are entire books that were written by Moses and Noah that we never get to see. I wanted you to see that information was lost. What you're going to see is the kind of things that quantum physics is revealing to us today in the language of science is largely what was lost in the language of another time. The power of human emotion and the role that emotion plays in the field that permeates all of creation. And how when we feel certain feelings in our bodies, it affects the world of our bodies and around our bodies. That's the kind of information that was lost. And I've been asked this question a lot. And the question simply says, do you think this information was taken? Wasn't this part of the conspiracy to keep us in the dark? To keep us disempowered? I've asked myself that question. I see no evidence whatsoever to suggest that there was a conspiracy to keep us in the dark. I've read the letters of the bishops who were on the council, and they struggled. They've struggled with what it would mean to take out the words of the prophets. They said, what if this book catches on? I mean, they had no way of knowing. What if the book catches on 300 years from now? What will it mean? Well, 2,000 years from now, we're still struggling with it. Having said that, when we say the books are lost, they're not really lost. And it's not like no one knows where they are. The books were removed and placed into the vaults of the church, of the Vatican Library, where very few people have access to, or private libraries like the Habsburgs in Germany. So having said that, I don't think there was a conspiracy per se. Any time in the last 1,700 years, the church could have come out and said, we were going through our library last week, we found these books. Although they are not part of our canonized biblical text, they're important. We think you might find them interesting, and here they are for your reading. And that never really happened. And I can't answer why. I can't speak for the church. I don't know why that is. And ultimately, it doesn't make any difference because the information is coming out in other ways. We know information was lost. We know those texts were lost because we're beginning to find records today. So we know that there have been at least two major breaks in the lineage of wisdom that links our modern world with our ancient world. One of those was the burning of the Library of Alexandria. The second were the biblical edits of the 4th century. And as we bring this kind of information together, we flesh out, we begin to piece together the missing elements of our lives, our time, our history, and perhaps this is the kind of information that begins to fill in the missing pieces, describing our relationship to the mind of God and the force that links all of creation and how we apply it in our lives in ways that are meaningful to us today. Through this section, I've attempted to share with you the implications of some of the lost text, the information that's part of our history, and how by not understanding perhaps how things have happened in the past, it may change or taint, or bias in some respects, the way we look at our lives today. If you're listening to this program and you're interested, for example, in the life of Jesus, Jesus and his life as a young man forms the basis of one of the three largest religions in the world. On the one hand, and on the other hand, through the traditions that have been handed to us, we know so very little about his childhood. So if you're interested in information about the birth in the young life of Jesus, how differently would you live your life knowing that the questioning and the experiments, the trial and error, the doubt that you feel in your life and your capabilities and the way you interface with the people around you, your judgments may in fact not be so very different from the life of even the young Jesus as he was growing into the wisdom and the power of what it meant to be with the abilities that he was given in this world and in his struggle to come to terms with them. So if this kind of information is of interest to you, we've barely scratched the surface in this brief section. I really encourage you, I invite you to explore on your own. There are entire compilations that are available now of lost books of the Bible. One of those is actually entitled Lost Books of the Bible, The Forgotten Book of Eden. And this is the book that describes the gospel, the birth of Mary, the infancy of Jesus, book one, the infancy of Jesus, book two, the letters of Herod and Pilate that I shared with you just a few moments ago, all the visions of the prophets, the Apostles' Creed. So this is a book that I highly recommend if you're interested in finding more of this kind of information. So if this kind of information, if it excites you the way that it does me, and if it stimulates within you a longing to know more of our past so that we may be wiser of our present, I really encourage you to search on your own with your family. Read through these texts, remembering that what we know now isn't wrong, it's simply incomplete. And together, perhaps we can fill in the missing pieces of our lost history. The most respected scholars of our day acknowledge that tremendous amounts of information have been lost in the last 2,000 years. Information that links our modern world today with the wisdom and the understandings of our ancestors and those who have come before us. So the question comes up, how do we know information was lost? If it's lost, how do we know it's lost? We're not seeing it. And the reason that we're beginning to understand, and the reason that we know, is because so much of the 20th century was about recovering information of our history and of our past. The 20th century, the century of science, that told us of the inner workings and the mechanism of nature and creation. And the 20th century was also the century that allowed us to recover more of our past and piece together those understandings than perhaps we have in all of recorded history. One of the great finds of the 20th century, what has been called the single greatest archaeological find of the last century, was found in an area that is known as the Qumran area along the shores of the Dead Sea in caves above the shores of the Dead Sea in clay vases that were still intact after thousands of years. There were a series of scrolls and documents and parchments that were found, and in those scrolls we began to find perhaps more information about our past and the most detailed information of our biblical history than we've ever found before. For listeners that may not be familiar with this find and what this find looks like, the library is called today the Dead Sea Scrolls Library. The library that we know today as Dead Sea Scrolls consists of parchments and documents that have been found strewn throughout a number of caves above the shores of the Dead Sea, and they're written on various kinds of medium. Some of the documents are actually written on animal hide, on parchment that has been rolled and preserved in the vases. The vases were actually covered with tar and pitch, and the lids were sealed to preserve and protect them from the elements over 1,500 years and 2,000 years and 2,500 years. Some of the documents are very intact. Some of them are scraps, no more the size than postage stamps. Some of the information was recorded upon papyrus paper, like the ancient Egyptians used, fragments of papyrus. Some of it was on lambskin. Some of it was on cattle skin. Some of the information was preserved on very finely pounded sheets of copper, with the letters actually incised into the copper with a strong wooden stylus. All of this information, tremendous amounts of information, was recovered between 1946 and 1959 in 11 caves on the shores on the western side of the Dead Sea, just outside of Jerusalem. Between those years, over 25,000 fragments of this copper and papyrus and parchment were discovered, and it was eventually pieced into approximately 900 scrolls. And those 900 scrolls, the job of piecing the scrolls together and of translating them and compiling the information and publishing, all of this was given to a team of only 7 scholars. And there were 7 male scholars. And up until very recently, those 7 scholars were the only people that had access to this library of information that's now known as the Dead Sea Scrolls Library. Well, the Dead Sea Scrolls Library has been very controversial and is in the news even today. The saga of the Dead Sea Scrolls is far from complete. One of the reasons that the library is so controversial is that it is within this library that we find the oldest recorded documents of the original books of the Hebrew Old Testament, the Hebrew book of the Torah, which became the first 5 books of the Christian Old Testament. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy are the books of the Western Bible and of the Hebrew Torah. The scribes who penned the information in these scrolls placed them in the caves long before the edits of the 4th century ever happened, so that when these documents were discovered for the first time in a very, very long time, we actually saw the original words, the original text in the book of Genesis and Exodus and Leviticus, Numbers and Deuteronomy, as well as other books of our biblical texts that had never been found. Can you imagine what it would have been like to have been a scholar, 1946, 1947, a young scholar, working in the field and going into the caves and finding these texts and translating them, and all of a sudden realizing that you're looking at documents, at books of the Bible that had not been seen for over 1,700 years? What would you have done with that kind of information? And the answer is, it was a very different world, 1946, 1947. We were just coming out of the war, out of World War II. And the answer at that time was, just don't tell anybody for a while. We kept them very, very quiet. And this is part of the saga and the mystery that goes along with the Dead Sea Scrolls, because so much of the information was reserved only for the scholars, and the general public really didn't have the opportunity to see many of the scrolls until as late as 1991. In 1991, through the efforts of modern-day scholars, the texts were actually freed up as microfiche and made available in the Huntington Library in Southern California for people to see today. However, it is going back into some of these original documents, and this is the value of going into these scrolls, it's because they begin to describe in the language of those who have come before us, in that original language, our relationship to the world around us and our relationship to the forces of our world. So to really understand what the scrolls are saying to us today, I think we have to ask the question, who recorded the scrolls in the first place? Where did the Dead Sea Scrolls come from? Scholars are pretty much in agreement that the scrolls originally were penned by a mysterious sect called the Ancient Essenes. And if the listeners are not familiar with the word the Essenes, E-S-S-E-N-E-S, they are a mysterious sect that we're beginning to learn more about today. We first hear about the Essenes arriving about 500 years before the time of Jesus on the shores of the Dead Sea in an area known as Qumran. In the Qumran area, the Essenes separated themselves from the societies and the communities around them so that they could live and honor the traditions of a teaching that was already ancient in their time. In this teaching, they would rise early in the morning and don white garments and engage in prayer until sunrise. And at sunrise, they would work in the fields. And for the Essenes, according to the historians, the Essenes did not see the work in the fields as a job that they had to do. Rather, they saw it as an opportunity, as a blessing, to give thanks and to interact with the forces of nature to provide for themselves and to provide food and nourishment for their families. It was an honor. At noontime, the Essenes would leave the fields, they would bathe in cold water, don white garments, and they would dine and pray with their families. They would go back into the fields again and work until sunset, at which time they would bathe in cold water again, don white garments, engage in prayer, and spend time with their families. We know about the Essenes primarily through the Roman historians, such as Josephus. And one of the things that we know is that the Essenes abhorred the eating of any flesh. They were vegetarians in the strictest sense. And many people believe that they were a celibate community, although we know they were not 100% celibate because they had families. So there were some that chose celibacy and they lived that lifestyle, and others that did not and chose to engage in family life and support their families. Well, the mystery of the Essenes and precisely who they were and where they came from. No one knows precisely where they came from. There are a lot of theories, and we really don't know for certain. What we know is that they were in the Qumran area about 500 years, not long after the crucifixion of Jesus. They were persecuted tremendously. We know this as well because we see archaeological remnants of their dwellings, their villages, still on the shores of Qumran today, and we see evidence and records of the persecution and of the flight. Now, this is where the story of the Essenes becomes really, really interesting. Because when they were persecuted, they fled the area. And when they fled, they carried records of their documents with them. Everywhere they went, they took records of what today we see as the Dead Sea Scrolls. And they carried them with them, and others they hid in the caves above the shores of the Dead Sea, thinking that someday they would come back to those libraries again. Obviously, they never did. Well, when they fled the area, the records show that they fled into the mountains of Egypt. And we find records of the Essenes going into the Sinai Peninsula in those areas today. We know that they fled into the highlands of Central Asia, in what today we call the area of Tibet. What is lesser known is the plight of the Essenes into the Americas. We know that today we find active Essene monasteries in South America between the borders of Bolivia and Peru. And there are records of the Essenes journeying down along the coasts and the borders. And recently, in the 20th century, evidence of the Essenes has actually been found in North America among the Native American tribes in the desert southwest, and the Navajo and the Hopi. And they speak about their brothers from the east that journeyed to them over 2,000 years ago and spoke to them of the elements of fire and air and water and earth, what the Essenes called the angels of the fire, the angels of the air, the angels of the water, and the angels of the earth. And this is so interesting. It's so interesting to me because so much of the history of North America is the story of Christianity coming to the native traditions to introduce a teaching in this land that is based upon the teachings of the ancient Essenes. And the irony may be that the native populations had already been introduced to precisely the same teachings almost 2,000 years earlier in a form that was so pure it was not recognized by the Spanish and by the Christians when they came into this world. They may have been speaking apples and apples and not even known it. So the irony and the possibilities are certainly worth considering. When we look at the events of history from the perspective of seeing patterns that may have direct application in our lives today, the plight of the Essenes may actually represent a way of perceiving that has even greater application in our lives today. Look at what happened with the Essenes. They found themselves isolated from the world around them intentionally so that they could live the truth of a wisdom and a teaching that had been with them and it was already ancient in their time, 500 years before the birth of Christ. After the crucifixion, they were persecuted and they fled their home and they carried their wisdom with them everywhere they went and integrated that wisdom into other spiritual traditions in the tribes throughout the world. And as we just mentioned, we find evidence of the Essenes in the mountains of Egypt, Bolivia, Peru, all through the American desert southwest, in China, in Tibet. The interesting thing about this is although the Essenes carried the information into these places much earlier, later other organizations came. The Spanish, for example, came to North America carrying their understandings of religion and Christianity, and the reality was that they were actually introducing it into a culture that was based on the original teachings of the Christian traditions and where they began. What does this mean in our lives today? What can we learn from the path of the Essenes and the way their information was dispersed and disseminated and assimilated by other organizations? Well, I'll invite you to look into your life. Look at the way that you perceive others. The interesting thing of our lives today is that although we all interpret our world so very differently, we essentially learn of our world through the common threads and the common denominators of our education system, our books, our references. So, such as many traditions assimilated the information of the Essenes and implemented it uniquely in their lives, the people around us assimilate the information of science, history, religion, and culture the same information and implement it uniquely in their lives. This is an opportunity for us. It represents an opportunity that perhaps by looking at the similarities between the people around us that we find most different, rather than focusing on the differences that we believe separate us from one another, we may in fact learn a tremendous lesson from the Essenes even today, 2,500 years after their plight. And if this is true, in that way, the Essenes are still the great teachers in the history and the present time of humankind. In my time as an aerospace engineer, I began researching the migration and the plight of the Essenes and how this body of information, this lineage of wisdom, found its way to so many different places throughout the world. One of the first journeys that this study led me upon was in 1986 into the mountains of Egypt, specifically on the Sinai Peninsula, to what today is recognized as one of the single most ancient monasteries has been continuously inhabited, St. Catherine's Monastery at the base of Mount Sinai in Egypt. What we know is that for over 1,500 years, the monastery at St. Catherine has remained intact. It's common for monasteries to be overrun by foreign armies over time, and they become fortresses or they become homes sometimes before they return to being a monastery again. And this has never happened in St. Catherine's Monastery. It has been continuously inhabited for over 1,500 years. And the monks that live in this monastery, they're fascinating. They're beautiful little men. They are Coptic and Christian and some Greek Orthodox. The monastery itself, on the exterior, looks deceptively primitive. It looks like old earthen brick and adobe walls. There's very little electricity in the monastery. The monks bake their bread in the sun. They pump their water first thing in the morning. They burn oil lamps for light and illumination. They arise about 4 a.m. and begin their day, and they're usually in bed by 6, 7 o'clock in the evening. The outside, however, is so deceptive once you enter into the main sanctuary, because for 1,500 years, the monks have had the opportunity to adorn the sanctuary with icons and images from throughout the world, and it is one of the most elegant, just magnificent, beautiful, beautiful sights that I have ever seen, and something you just wouldn't expect to see in the deserts of High Egypt. In 1997, there was a very sad time for the people of Egypt. In the fall of 97, there was a massacre of foreign tourists in an area known, they call it Luxor, but it was actually about 60 miles outside of Luxor, on the west bank of the Nile. German tourists, depending on how many and whose account it was, 60 to 65 tourists were killed by now what we know were very well-organized terrorists financed by other countries. It was a very sad time for the Egyptians. First of all, they were embarrassed by what they were not Egyptians that did the massacre. They didn't want the world to think of them as and associate them with something like that. It was also a very frightening time. U.S. Embassies, many embassies, they closed. Tour companies pulled out. Hundreds and hundreds of tours canceled in 1 week. And for the next year and a half, the tourism, that's the 80% of the gross national product of Egypt, was almost non-existent. Just from this terrorism, it had accomplished its purpose. That's what they were trying to do. Well, it just happened that we were on our way into Egypt with a group during that time. The next week, we were going over, and I called everyone in the group and asked them how they felt about going, if they would like to postpone, cancel, go forward with the group. And this is always, it's the interesting part of the story. There were only two people that chose to stay home. One of them was my mother, and the other one was my wife's sister. So the family wasn't comfortable, but everyone else was comfortable with going. They said, this is what this trip is all about. So we did. We went into Egypt during this time, and it was a really interesting experience. It was, the hotels were absolutely empty. The streets were relatively empty. The airport was empty. We'd been there a few days, and President Mubarak found out that we were there with a tour group. And he was so honored that we came into his country during a time of mourning and when it was really very sad. And he wrote a letter And he sent a letter to our translators and our guides that gave us permission to go into sites. Some of them I had never been in 15 years in leading groups into Egypt. Some had never been open to the West. And one of those areas was here in St. Catherine's Monastery. The monks that have lived here for 1,500 years, they have a belief that the energy of the monastery lives in the body of the monks as well. So every time a monk dies, their bodies are retained on the property so that they're not, the energy of the monastery isn't scattered. And what they do is they have a ritual. They'll bury the bodies for a period of time, and when nothing is left but bone, when there's only a skeleton left, they disinter the body, they bring it to a special part of the monastery, and they separate the bones. And they have a room for skulls, and a room for femurs, and a room for rib cages. And they can tell you, down to the skull, you know, where Brother John from 1604, where his skull is. This was the first time they ever allowed us access to that room and allowed us to photograph it. And I'm saying this to you for a reason. Because not only do they keep all the bodies of all that have ever studied or lived here in the monastery, they keep a record of every spiritual tradition that's ever come through this monastery in a library that is second only to the Vatican in terms of Christian religious texts, Christian literature. And we had access to that library. And there's a window, but the window has paper, brown paper from a paper bag taped over it. They have never let us look into that room. And I've tried before. So they're really nice monks, and they're very playful, very childlike in their innocence in some respects. So we were playing with them. We said, well, what's on the other side of that door? And they said, we can't show you. And they said, well, you know, please, just show us what's in there. No, we can't. I said, please show us what's in there. And they said, well, okay. So we were not able to photograph what was in there, but they opened the door, and it was an absolutely amazing experience. And it's relative to what's happening in the world now is why I'm sharing it. On the other side of that door is in a low-tech monastery of oil lamps and icons from the Middle Ages is a very high-tech room of 386 at that time and 486-based Microsoft and Intel chips, processors, Macintosh, IBM, flatbed scanners, and satellite uplinks. And through our translator, I look at them and I said, what in the world are you guys doing here? And he got very quiet. And he was not smiling when he said what I'm about to share with you. He said, we feel certain that in this lifetime, in these days, that there will be a war in this part of the world, and this monastery will either be taken over or destroyed. Before that happens, we would like to record every page of every book that we have and send it up onto the World Wide Web for future generations. And this is what they were doing. Well, since then, and we went back again in 99, they were having problems with the web space and the website, so they are still recording page by page. They can't do it online, so now they're doing it to CD-ROM. It's still happening. Bless their hearts. I mean, they have a sense there, the Israelis have a sense in the Shrine of the Book Museum that something big is going to happen in that part of the world. I don't know what it means, I just think it's interesting to see that similarity. Well, it was throughout this library that we had the opportunity to see hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of volumes of ancient biblical manuscripts. Some of them date back as far as the Dead Sea Scrolls, in Aramaic, in Hebrew, in ancient Greek. In addition to the Old Testament manuscripts, we also saw New Testament manuscripts that were edited, beautiful illuminated manuscripts. Some of them were on pages that were made of wood, where the actual letters were hammered into the wood itself, and the gold and the silver and the copper were hammered to inlay every one of the letters, and the images are hand-painted onto the pages. Just magnificent. Many of the documents that we find in this part of the world are documents that are only legendary in some respects. There was a movie recently, Stigmata, that was loosely based on a legendary document that is called the Lost Gospel of Thomas. And there is a Gospel of Thomas, and we actually saw pages of the Lost Gospel of Thomas in the St. Catherine's Library. So I'm sharing this story because of the camaraderie that developed with the monks, their feeling of what will happen in that part of the world, and the wisdom that they hold and they preserve in their part of the world. And I'm sharing it because it's not unique. The same thing has happened in other parts of the world. 1998, I had both the honor and the privilege of leading a pilgrimage into the highlands of central Tibet. It was the first time that I had seen this land and that many of the people with me had ever seen the land. The Tibetan people, they're a fascinating people. And of the many things they represent today, they are tremendous record keepers. They have records of Buddhist and pre-Buddhist traditions. Before Tibetan Buddhism existed, they were of a belief system, a religion that was called Bon, B-O-N. Very, very similar to native North American traditions of the Hopi and the Navajo. And there's so many similarities between the cultures. Their creation stories are so similar. Their sand paintings are so similar. Their beliefs in the elements of nature and the way they work. So in addition to the Buddhist literature and the pre-Buddhist literature that the Tibetans hold in their monasteries, there have always been legends of Christian, pre-Christian, and biblical books actually held in those Tibetan monasteries. The purpose of our journey, I wanted to go into this very mysterious land and see if we could find those links, see if we could find evidence of the Essenes in these monasteries, and if so, what it might mean, the light that it could possibly shed onto our understandings of what we know about our own history. And my question was, is it possible that in the monasteries of Tibet, halfway around the world, high in the Himalayas, is it possible we could have records of our own history in those monasteries that are more complete there than what we have in our own libraries here? Tibet is an amazing land. It's beautiful. It is, without exception, the single most difficult journey that I've ever embarked upon or that I've ever led a group upon. And it's difficult for a number of reasons. The sheer elevation. We were up at elevation 16,000, 17,500 feet above sea level. Nothing lives in these elevations. There are no trees, there are no plants. There's only the snow on the mountains. There's the water, the earth beneath your feet. And you and God, that's all that's there. I remember thinking to myself, this may be the reason why so many revelations seem to come from such high and remote, desolate places, is because there are no diversions that are there. It's just us and the world around us, and there's nothing to distract us, nothing to distract our attention. We met some of the most amazing, amazing people throughout our journey. There was one afternoon as we were crossing a pass 16,500 feet above sea level. And of course, there's no way to let these people know you're coming. You can't send them a fax or a phone call. And we were crossing a high mountain pass, and we stopped. And there was a herd of yak. The yak are the most fascinating animals. They look almost prehistoric, very otherworldly. Tremendous dark fur, large flat tails, like skunk's tails, on an animal that looks like the size of a cow, except it's covered in fur that looks like a bear. And they are the most beautiful animals. And we stopped at this pass to look at this herd of yak, and out of a yak-haired tent, the most beautiful woman walked out, and she walked up to our translator. And I remember looking into her eyes. They were so clear and crisp and white. And she had a gaze that was so certain and so confident. And she began to smile at us, and she looked at us, and she says, "What are you doing here?" through the translator. "What are you doing here?" And we said, "We've come to see your country." And her demeanor changed, and she began telling us a story. She asked a question. She looked at me in the eyes, and she said, "Do you know how special this time in the history of our world and in the family of our global people, how special this time really is?" And she began telling me about great changes that would happen upon the earth and happen within the family of humankind during this time in history. And I looked at her through the translator, and I said, "How do you know about these things?" "We know because we study it in our country." And what I began to understand was it's part of their culture. It's part of their tradition. People throughout the world, the indigenous peoples, they understand that something very, very special is happening in our world now, and that this isn't a time just like any other time in history. So we met a number of tribes that were herding yak as we were going through the areas. We spent, in 23 days, we were in 12 monasteries and two different nunneries in our entire journey. And much of the time, as we would go into the monasteries and into the nunneries, we would sit among the monks and the nuns. We didn't come in as observers and watch them. They invited us to join them. And they sang their prayers of peace and their chants for us. And I had my native wooden flutes with me, and we played our prayers of peace, and we sang back for them. What we discovered was that our group of about 26 people, the only song that we all knew that we could sing together was Old MacDonald. So as we would go into the monasteries and the nunneries to return the gift of the song, we would sing Old MacDonald together and trying to make it relevant to their part of the world, we would sing a yak yak here and a yak yak there. And the Tibetans have a tremendous ear for rhythm. There's a reason I'm sharing this story. While they could never get the words to the song, they could get the refrain. And the refrain and their ear for rhythm, instead of E-I-E-I-O, became, in the Tibetan idiom,
E-I-E-I-O.
And this mantra of E-I-E-I-O actually traveled faster than we did through the monasteries and the nunneries of Tibet. It preceded us, and it established a camaraderie and a friendship that was priceless. Significant in this story, because Tibet is a living culture. When you go into the temples of Egypt, you're looking at stone walls that were created thousands of years ago, and the people and the culture that left them have long since disappeared. So the wisdom that they left, we're only guessing at what it really says. In Tibet, it's a living culture, and you cannot simply walk in and say, "Let me see your library," and leave, nor would I choose to, because the people are so much a part of what's happening. And the beauty of this camaraderie is that we could look into the eyes of the people, and as they were having their prayers and going through their spiritual experiences in the monasteries, we could ask them, what happens to you inside of your body? What are you feeling? What are you experiencing inside when we see you do these things on the outside? So as we went through the nunneries and the monasteries along the way, and our mantra of E-I-E-I-O preceded us, we were greeted very, very warmly. We were given experiences that, my understanding is, that a lot of other people have never had. And I've since returned to Tibet, and that the friendship and the camaraderie that was established in 1998 became a foundation for what I'm about to share next, and what we found in these monasteries. There was one particular monastery toward the end of the journey in 1998, and it was in this monastery where we were given a private audience with a holy man. And in this audience, we had the opportunity to ask him the question that I had asked every monk and every nun through the translators that we had come across. And it was his answer that became so powerful in my understanding of how the ancient traditions play into our lives today. I asked the holy man, "When we see your mudras and your mantras and the bells and the bowls and the gongs and the chimes and the incense, when we see you chant for 14, 18 hours a day, when we see your prayers on the outside," I said, "what happens? What does happen to you on the inside? What happens inside of your body?" And he looked at me, and through the translator, he chuckled. And he began to share with me something that was so powerful and so profound, yet so simple. And what he said to me, he says, "You've never seen our prayers, because a prayer cannot be seen." He said, "What you have seen is what we do to create a feeling in our bodies. And the feeling is the prayer. The feeling is the prayer." And then he turned it on me and he asked me, he says, "How do you do it in your culture?" And what I began to understand is when our biblical text, our religious documents were edited in the 3rd and 4th century, much of the information that was lost is precisely the information that tells us how powerful and how important feeling and emotion are in our culture, in our society, and in our prayers. And without that information, many of us perhaps believe if we say the right words, the right number of times, the right time of day, or the right time of year, that we have in fact said the prayer. And we wonder sometimes why our prayers aren't answered. And what this man was telling me was that the words are not the prayers. He said it's the feeling that underlies the words. And that all of the chants, all of the tones, all of the time they're spending in these monasteries and the nunneries, this is what it took for them, how long it took for them to get into the place where they could embody that feeling in their lives. Well, this is going to be important for us in just a little while as we begin discussing the lost modality of prayer, feeling-based prayer, and what it means in our lives today. Well, our meeting with the holy man happened in 1998. 2001, I had the opportunity to return to the same monastery again with a different group of people. The holy man was no longer there. Everyone we asked, no one knew where he went. We were never able to find him again. However, as synchronicity would have it, it just happened that precisely on the day that we arrived at this monastery, it was a day of great celebration. It was a holiday in the Tibetan culture, and all the monks and all the nuns were required to leave the monasteries, leave the nunneries, go to the nearest village, and celebrate the holidays. There were just a couple of people left to watch over the monastery during the time they were gone. Well, there was a young monk who was there, and he was so willing to help us have our experience. We asked him when we arrived at this monastery, "Do you have a library in this monastery?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "Would it be possible for us to see this library?" And he said, "No, it's not possible. It's a hidden library. It's secret." And I said, "But we know about it." And he laughed. And he said, "If you know about it, then it's no longer a secret." He said, "However, it's locked today." And I'll just say right now that time and distance mean very little to the Tibetan people. And he says, "If you'd like to see it, I'll have to get the keys." Well, what he didn't tell me was that the keys were in a house that was 30 miles away. And this beautiful little monk couldn't have been any more than 14, 15 years old. He rode his bicycle 30 miles in one direction to get the keys while we waited. And we had very creative things to do to fill our time. And rode that bicycle 30 miles back and was so proud. He was grinning from ear to ear as he placed that key into the huge bolted doors that guard the outer walls of this monastery. And he opened the door and he let us in, and we were inside immediately into a completely empty chanting hall. It's the most amazing sight, the huge tapestries, beautifully brightly colored tapestries that hang from the ceiling. And the monasteries are never heated, so the chill of the monastery immediately greeted us as we came through the door. And the Tibetan idea of warmth, if you are cold, you wrap more garments around you rather than heating the space that you're in. And as we entered into this completely vacant chanting hall, a massive altar was in front of us, in front of the room. And what we knew was that behind that altar was a false wall and a library. And the library was about 3 stories tall and only about 12 feet wide. And in that library, there would be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books. And he led us down a passageway with 30-foot tall Buddhas of compassion on either side of us. And as we entered into a completely darkened room, we turned on our flashlights, the lights from our video cameras, and immediately we were surrounded and overwhelmed by the sight of bookcases 3 stories tall with literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of very ancient Tibetan texts covered with dust. Some of them, the pages were so old they would almost crumble to the touch. The bookcases go so high into the room around us that our lights wouldn't even illuminate the highest shelves that were there. We couldn't even see the books that were up on top. And our translator was there. And I asked the translator, I said, "This is amazing. This is an amazing place. What's in these books?" And he looked at me and he smiled and he said, "Everything." And I said, "What do you mean, everything?" And he came over and he poked me right in the chest as he was saying it. And he says, "Everything." He said, "Every spiritual tradition that's ever come through this monastery, we have a record of, including yours." And I said, "How do you know?" And he said, "Here, I'll show you." And he pulled a book down from the bookcase, apparently at random. He opened it up and he began reading. And what he read to me was almost word for word the Essene Gospels of Peace and Elements of the Dead Sea Scrolls in a Tibetan monastery on this dusty old bookshelf. And I said, "Where did this come from?" And he said, "It was left here a very, very long time ago." And I didn't know until I returned back into the States, and I actually found the documents from some of the Roman historians that say that the Romans chased the Essenes into Tibet in the first century and lost track of them. And we were now finding evidence of precisely the kinds of documents that show that that is what happened. Well, I'm sharing these stories for a reason, and there are many more stories that we could share. But the reason is this. We know that tremendous amounts of information have been lost in the lineage of wisdom that links us with our past. The implications of that loss of wisdom are vast. Because today, many of our scientific principles, our spiritual understandings, the way we view medicine, our historic beliefs, as good as they are, and they are good, however, they are based in incomplete records. They're simply incomplete. Along with the Dead Sea Scrolls and the books of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the information that also I just shared earlier, There was another library that was discovered approximately the same time in history that picks up where the Dead Sea Scrolls leave off. The controversy of the Dead Sea Scrolls is that for the first time in a very long time, in almost 1700 years, some of the books of the Dead Sea Scrolls showed us the information that was edited from our biblical text over 1700 years ago. When the scrolls were discovered, those books were revealed for the first time in a very long time regarding the Old Testament only. Now, 1946, 1947, around the same time the scrolls were being discovered, another library called the Nag N-A-G Hammadi, H-A-M-M-A-D-I, library was discovered in Egypt as well. Seeing the controversy of the scrolls, this library was immediately turned over to the authorities. It was translated and released in a very, very brief period of time. And the significance of the Nag Hammadi library is that it picks up where the Old Testament scrolls leave off with the New Testament books that were edited during the 4th century, during the Nicaean edits of the Emperor Constantine. And the Nag Hammadi library then goes even further with the New Testament traditions and many of the lost Gospels that we're only now beginning to understand. If we could summarize all this lost information, if we could summarize everything that we find in those edited biblical texts or in the Tibetan monasteries or in the Egyptian monasteries or in the monasteries of Peru, if we could summarize all of it together, what does it say to us today? What does it offer us today? Well, if we could bring it all together in a single sentence, it describes a greater understanding of our relationship to the world around us, to one another, and to the cosmos beyond. It tells us that we are part of something much, much greater, and then it takes us one step further, because these ancient records actually leave us the instructions of precisely how we implement these understandings in our lives. And the rest of this program now will be dedicated to developing those understandings of how we implement these ancient understandings into our lives, make them applicable in our world today.